Talking about Noah. I'm going to go through some more of this story. It's one of the more interesting stories more fascinating stories. Anything else? And what's particularly fascinating about the story of Noah is that both the geological and archaeological evidence supports the story, as well as some of the other stories that exist, seemingly totally independent from Jewish history, in other cultures, that also have stories about the flood, and the essence of those stories being essentially identical. So the evidence of the Middle Eastern people all coming from a singular ancestry that had survived the flood is pretty indisputable. You don't find a whole lot of people trying to do battle with it because the evidence is too strong. Now, I'll tell you, for me, I don't know about you, maybe I'm more of a doubting Thomas, but I've kind of needed some of that evidence because the story is so weird, so bizarre, that it's just hard for me to take it in, but the fact is, it happened. So, one thing, if a person does say, oh gee, how can that happen? Hey, believe me, the evidence is irrefutable that there at least was a localized flood. Whoa, that's quite a reverberation there. I suspect that. Does the volume need to be turned down a little, Grace? Yeah, turn down a little bit. Grace is pounding on the glass. You got her hands over there. Her daughter is walking around in a daze, All right. Is that better, or does it need to go down a little more? It's okay right there. All right, good. Let's dive in to the flood. Excuse me, it was not intentional. what's that? Deep. Very good. Okay. We talked about the preparations last week. Noah building the boat, took him a long time. There's some, by the way, who believe that Noah probably was a fairly wealthy fellow and had lots. One of the theories that he had a lot of servants. I mean, getting a boat and all the different species, there's some, I read one reference that said that they calculated that you could fit about 6,000 species, pairs of species, into this ark. That's a lot. And that's a lot of work to do. So could Noah have done that just with his three sons? Well, I'm not sure. They had a lot of time. On the other hand, animals don't last forever. So I don't know what exactly happened. Some have theorized that he had a huge set of servants that would have helped him out and then gotten locked out. But that's a whole nother story. Thanks, guys. checks in the mail, right? I know, it's kind of hard to laugh out there. Anyway, let's pick up at chapter 7, verse 1. The Lord said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of the animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female." Now the Jews would have understood what that meant because there were some very specific categories of what a clean animal was versus an unclean animal. The clean animals were those that were okay for the Jews to eat or to offer sacrifices and to eat. I mean, they could do both. And so they were going to make sure that there was an extra abundance. And the seven apparently means seven pairs. So that's a lot. Seven pairs of the clean animals, just a pair of each of the ones that were not appropriate for consumption, at least at that time. Probably good reasons for it. We don't know all the reasons, but we know a little bit of it. We understand things like trichinosis and some other, ailments or diseases that people can pick up from improperly prepared foods. Some substances are a little more hazardous than others, and some more sensitive to preparation methods than others. And so, who knows what all the reasons were, but there were some sort of reasons. It says also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep the offspring alive on the face of the earth. So they need a lot of birds. You know, I wish he hadn't included pigeons and crows, but they did, and maybe he could have just done a pair of them. I kind of wondered if maybe he got confused in his count and took 14 pigeons or something. I don't know. I haven't been able to figure that one out. But they did it. They pulled these animals together, and he says, after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land everything living that I have made. Noah did according to all that the Lord had commanded him. Okay, well, we're told he was about 600 years old, and he did, you know, all of this stuff. Verse 10, it came about after the 7 days that the water of the flood came upon the earth. And in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, we're being pretty precise here, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, a lot of people wondered how this happened. There's a lot of theories about it. Some have said that there was a great subsidence. A subsidence is where land actually subsides. I mean, it goes down, settles, or some big thing. And if it did, because some have theorized that, because if it did settle in that area, I mean, you got the Black Sea in the north, and you've got the Indian Sea down there on the to the southeast, and then you've got the Mediterranean. And if all of that, if that Middle Eastern area had a great subsidence, some sort of cataclysmic event, a real major thing, then you could get, you know, just this flooding in from those different seas that could certainly make it, certainly flood it. On the other hand, there could have been some sort of astronomical event, a meteor that came down, hit somewhere else. Too loud, huh? All right, too loud. Can you turn down a little bit more? People are now just banging their heads against the walls. Okay. Is that too low, or is that okay? That's all right. So there's a lot of theories about how this could have happened, and we don't know what happened, but we know it was a combination of some sort of flooding from below and an immense rainfall for 40 days straight that just caused such flooding that, as we'll see, it even that the elevation of the water went above the mountains. Does that mean that the mountains came down and the floods came up? You know, I don't know exactly which way it happened. But it did happen. And again, we said last week, it's not clear whether it was just a localized flood in that Mediterranean area wiping out everything there, or whether it was worldwide. Now, I tend to think it was probably localized, but it could have easily been worldwide if God decided it needed to be, because he can do whatever he wants to do, as we know. So verse 13, on the same day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, sons of Noah, and Noah's wife, and the 3 wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, and the cattle and the creeping things and the birds, it says, and every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. I don't know why he added that little line. Okay, so we have that. Then let's skip down to verse 17. Then the flood came upon the earth for 40 days, and the water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. Now, that, you know, I was thinking about that. This is not a luxury liner we're talking about, right? I mean, this is just, it's got to be the biggest ship that anybody had even imagined at that time. And we're talking, again, as we said last week, it's about 150 yards long, right? 450 feet long. That's huge. And so you got a, you know, I think it was about 75 feet wide. I mean, this is a big thing, and it's there, just this mass of wood. It's covered with pitch. You got all these animals in it. It had to be frightening hearing what's going on the outside. The rain is beating down on this thing. The waters are lapping up against the sides, and who knows? You've seen some of these pictures from the old artwork of people's imagination about the ark, and you have people beating on the sides of it, you know, saying, oh, I want to get in. I mean, it had to really be a terrifying, terrifying feeling. And you got this little group of people huddled inside with all the noise of these animals, and then things start to creak, and it lifts off the earth. And you start to feel that it's floating. That had to be, a real sensation. Talking about extreme things. You know, I mean, this was an event that had to change some lives there, you know. So the family's huddled there. The ship has just lifted off, and it's being battered around by the waves. I don't know what kind of ballast they had in this or anything else, because I don't know how stable this thing was. Build a ship that big, and you got this storm out there. I mean, a lot of things could happen, but God knew what He was doing, and so clearly helped Noah to make sure that they would survive. The water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water, and the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits higher. 15 cubits. A cubit is the distance from your fingertip to your elbow. It's kind of a convenient measure. Not real precise, because everybody's a little different, right? But it's a convenient measure. And they roughly say that's about 18 inches. That's kind of the going rate. It probably was closer to 16 or something like that. But so 15 cubits higher than the highest peak in that area. Again, we don't know whether the peaks went down from some sort of subsidence or what. But it covered everything, at least in that area. Verse 21, all the flesh that moved on the earth perished. Birds and cattle and beasts and every swarming thing that swarms upon the earth and all mankind. Of all that was on dry land and all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life died. So thus He blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, and they were blotted out from the earth, and only Noah was left together with those that were with him in the ark. And listen to this. And the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Now, that's a long time. That's 5 months, right? For 5 months, they are in this boat. They have food. You know, they don't have refrigeration, right? So they got, who knows what, I mean, the food was probably not, particularly tasty, but they had food. They certainly had a lot of animals. They had plenty of aromas to keep them awake. This had to be a really tough thing. And they did this for 5 months straight. The thing, it was completely covered. They did not see the light of day. There was a little window at the top that they kept bolted in because they didn't have a lot of, Anderson hadn't invented a lot of windows that were waterproof by then, you know. And so it was, this was dark. It was shut in. It was tough stuff. And and they're just floating around. They're bobbing around, not having a clue where they are for that long. If you are claustrophobic, you might not have liked that. I mean, it's a big boat, but, you know, I mean, it's dark inside too, right? And you don't go anywhere without bumping into a camel or a lion or something like that. So it's, this is not easy. And they're in there for 150 days. 150 days. Now here's some good news, actually, in verse 8. Or chapter 8, verse 1. But God remembered Noah. That's actually a very telling verse. That's an important verse because, I mean, if you're, I don't know about you, but again, you think, try to put yourself in Noah's sandals. They, you know, I mean, because maybe he had wellies. I don't know if you know what wellies are. I would have been wearing wellies, you know. One of those, you know, I actually probably needed boots that came up to here, you know, with all those animals. But the point is, I mean, put yourself in his hip boots and you got to say, you know, you're bothering with God. You said 40 days and 40 nights here. It's been 5 months. It's been 150 days. God, where are you? And what is going on? And, you know, I think that's kind of telling. God remembered Noah here finally. I mean, he hadn't forgotten him, of course, but this was important because this doesn't really tell us about God, per se, but it tells us about Noah and his perception of God. He was afraid God had forgotten about them. I mean, he didn't know God like we know him today. We have the benefit of the person of Jesus Christ who walked on this earth, and we saw what God is like when he puts himself in human form. And we see a loving, caring, you know, gregarious God who is there just healing people and dealing with the people in just such a tremendously effective way that just drew people to him and, of course, drew his enemies away from him. But it was, I mean, we know that about God today, but they didn't know that about God then. I mean, they don't know God is God. I mean, he can do whatever he wants to do, and they didn't know whether he was loving or whether he was, you know, really take it out. I mean, look what he chose to do. He destroyed the whole earth. Talk about vengeance. And so Noah's there bobbing around, you know, and where's God? God, it's, you know, past 40 days now. I mean, I don't know if they're marking it on the sides or what, but this is getting long. And now, no doubt God had given them enough direction to know that it was going to have to, they were going to have at least a year's supply of food, because remember, these are agricultural people here. I mean, they understand that food comes from tilling the ground, and if you destroy the crop, it's not that you just don't eat for that for a couple of weeks and then you go back down to Lucky's and buy what you need. You know, no, you've wiped it out and it's wiped out. And you got to, so they would have a year's supply of food, but they didn't know how long it was going to be, apparently. But God remembered him. I had a friend who was a very devout Jew, Orthodox Jew. He's a school teacher. He taught in the room next to me. We're both math teachers, and we had some nice conversations from time to time. And he's one of these guys who was, I mean, he was just very, very serious about his relationship to God, and he was also very open, very secure in what he believed. And so I asked him one day, and I said, you know, what do you think of? And when you think of God, if you had to choose one word to describe him, of two choices, what would you choose? Would you choose a loving God, or would you choose a judgmental God? He said, oh, it's easy, it's a judgmental God. And there's no question. Now, there's a big difference between being a Christian and being a Jew, and I would go on to say, being almost any other religion, per se. Your concept of God has got to be completely fashioned by the immensity of God, the awesomeness of God, the irritation that God must have because of what his creation does. And this fellow, he knew the Old Testament. He never read the New Testament, but he read the Old Testament. He knew all about it. He knew it well. And, of course, you read the Old Testament, and that's all you see of God, and that's all you see of man. And even if you believe God's a loving God, the story that the Old Testament tells of man is enough to say, God, how could you possibly put up with all of this? Even if you think God's loving, you've got to think that he's reached his last straw. But that's the difference between a view of God that is without the knowledge of Jesus Christ and a view of God that is with the knowledge of Jesus Christ. The knowledge of Jesus Christ helps us understand a loving God who is abundantly patient and abundantly pouring out Himself for us. And it's not surprising to us to read this verse, God remembered Noah. But Noah wasn't so sure. He didn't know that. We take a lot of things for granted. Important for us to understand. You know, and before we move on, this is really very applicable to us. We go through our months sometimes of darkness. You know, we think we've done what God asked us to do. We've gone off to do something. We've taken a job, or we've made some decisions that we thought were the right thing. We prayed about it. We tried to get some help. And we've gone to make that, and things haven't turned out the way we thought they were going to turn out. Sometimes it's kind of dark. Like it's dark inside that ark. And we wonder where God is. We wonder what He's doing. And we wonder why He doesn't change things for us. And I think we've pointed out before, one of the most common words in the New Testament, in the lists of attributes that God is interested in developing within us human beings, one of the most common is the word hupomeno, which is a Greek word for hanging in there. It's a Greek word for patience. We usually translate it patience. It's right there. I mean, if you looked at the four big ones, you'd have faith. Actually, you'd have love first. You probably would have patience second. Then you have, of course, hope. Did I say faith? Faith, hope, love, and patience. You'd have kind of those four here and there in all the lists and in different combinations. Patience, very, very big word. Well, that's what God is doing with us. And that's what He's doing with Noah. 5 months. Well, let's move on. The waters subsided, and the fountains, verse 2, also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained, and the water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the water decreased. So He's taken us back a little and now brought us forward again. So it says that in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. That's modern-day Turkey. Some of you probably have noticed some years ago there were some several reports of sightings of a large dark outline underneath the ice on Mount Ararat. I don't know what the mount's called today, there's been a couple people who have brought pieces of petrified wood that they thought that they've claimed came from something on this mountainside. Unfortunately, this particular mountainside is covered with ice all the time, snow and ice, and it's rare that it melts down enough to even get anywhere. There have been a number of expeditions that have tried to go up and find it, and if you've read any of reports of these things, they're really, really interesting because they've met with incredible obstacles, opposition, and all kinds of stuff, and so nobody has been able to find it. Halfway through, he says, Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. This is the first he had seen the ground. That's a long time. I mean, it's been not it was 150 days, and then it was another 40 days, and then it was another couple weeks, right? I mean, we're talking a long time here. And about 8 months, or about 7 months probably. And he finally takes the coverings off so he can see. He had this little window, but the window was not, I mean, it wasn't much to look out. You know, it wasn't a real, it wasn't a 360-degree view of the bay. You know, I mean, it was just this little window, and he didn't see anything. So now he took off the coverings of the ark. I don't know how they did that. They knocked them off with hammers or something. He recognized that the earth was dry again, and he said it says here in verse 15, God spoke to Noah saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your son, you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and bring out every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." Of course, that's the same words that God had given to Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply. It's time to get started. It's a whole new fresh start. So they did this. And in verse 20, Noah built an altar to the Lord. An altar was just a stack of stones, by the way. It wasn't necessarily one of these things you saw in the, you know, you see at the Acropolis or something, it was all nicely carved, as, you know, with letters across the front. No, it was just a stack of stones. That was an altar. Stack of stones. And why was that significant? Because you didn't find natural stacks of stones in the middle of nowhere. You knew that man had done it, and that's what people would do as a memorial or whatever. They'd make a stack of stones. And as a testimony that there's been, man has been here. And so he did that. He built this altar, and he took of every clean animal, every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings to the Lord. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. I've always disliked that translation, by the way. And the Lord said to himself, "I will never again curse the ground on account of man. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I'll never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease." Now we'll read more about that next time, but the point is that God says, "I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to destroy the earth." Notice he didn't just say by a flood. Now in the next chapter we'll read about him, you know, promising not to do it by flood again. But in this little promise it says, "I will never again curse the ground on account of man." Even though, and he says it, even though the intent of man's heart continues to be evil. He gives him this fresh start, but God's no fool. He understands what's going on. And he knew, for whatever reason, he had to do what he had to do. But he knew it wasn't going to solve the problem. It solved some sort of problem that he chose to solve. And he did start fresh with this little group of people. Founded on one guy who was just trying to listen to God and do what was right. But God knew that it was going to be a problem still. He just said, "I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to destroy it again. So be it. That's okay. Don't live in fear. Don't live in fear." And that's basically the message to Noah. Don't live in fear, Noah. Go and be fruitful and multiply. I know man's heart continues to be evil, but be fruitful and multiply. That's particularly appropriate because last week we mentioned that the real relevance of these passages are given to us in the New Testament. That's the best way to understand the Old Testament is when the New Testament tells us something about it. We can be pretty safe there. And last week we covered a couple of those different ways in which the New Testament talks about it. And one of the ways, two other ways, exist, and one of those is when Jesus talks about the second coming, the end times. And he says, look, just like people were kind of going about doing their things, living their lives, marrying and giving in marriage, he says, eating and drinking, and then all of a sudden the flood came. He said, it'll be the same way when I come back again. He didn't say it exactly that way, but he was talking about his second coming. He was talking about God dealing with man. And but he said it'll be just that same way. People will be doing their thing, and then the end events will happen. It won't be with a lot of warning. On the other hand, it will be with a lot of warning. But that would be to those who are listening. To those who aren't listening, the warning sounds won't be heard. We as believers, of course, we're trying to listen to God. That's all we're doing. You know, none of us are particularly special. None of us are particularly, pious. None of us are particularly perfectly behaved. None of us have it all together so that we can strut up before God and say, hey, what can I do for you today? You know? None of us have that. I mean, we're just people. We're just walking around and we're trying to live our lives, and we make a lot of stupid decisions, and we say dumb things, we do dumb things. I mean, it's just kind of, that's the way we live. And we hope that we are listening to God, and for the most part, we do try to. We really do. I'm God's people. I do see God constantly grabbing them when they're starting to stray, and pulling them back in line, and saying, "Oh yeah, God, I better listen to you, shouldn't I? Yeah, I'm getting kind of willful. I guess I should listen to you." But the fact is, we're listening to God, and in that sense, we become like Noah and his family. But the rest of the world is out there, and we shouldn't be too surprised that the majority don't follow the things of Christ. We shouldn't be shocked at that. Jesus said it very clearly. He says, "Narrow is the gate." Right? Narrow is the gate leading to salvation. Few there are that find it. We shouldn't be shocked at that. Now, it doesn't mean we don't pray for the people that haven't found a relationship with Christ. No, of course we should pray. Agonize for them. Our hearts, we can't get away from having a heart that does have a slightly open wound there in the knowledge of so many who are wandering without any touch with Christ. I had some conversations last night at a retirement party for Karen's uncle, and for the most part, most of the people there are not Christians. There's a few Christians, and I had some interesting conversations with a few people, and I just, you know, my heart just goes out to these poor people. They're just trying to live and trying to do their things and just don't want to have anything to do with God. I just don't want to have anything to do with it. That's just it. And it's tough. And it becomes just like the people outside Noah's boat. Now, on the other side of things, we have a beautiful passage in 2 Peter. Not the same one we read last time, but 2 Peter chapter 2, or chapter 3. That gives a very profound analysis, I'll say, of this whole flood event. Now, we read last week the preceding passage to this verse. We read last week, I think, verses 18 through 20, where, and we'll be done here in a minute, so... Don't worry, I know we're going a little long, but that's all right. Last week we read about this strange thing about Jesus going and trying to minister to the people who had died in the days of the people that died because of the flood. And that was a strange statement, but we talked about that. But then he says, verse 21, that Noah, or actually the end of verse 20, he says... It talks about Noah. He says the few, that is eight persons who were brought safely through the water. Verse 21, and corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. What is that saying? He says this whole, we have the story of Noah, and it's a great story, and we see what happened, and God rescues these eight people. He has to physically rescue them. Not just from the floodwaters, but he rescued them from a civilization that had totally gone astray. And the way that he did it was preserving them physically while he had to destroy that civilization. And what Peter is saying here is that today it doesn't work the same way, but we have kind of an analogy. In the same way that Noah and his family were rescued inside that ark, the security of that ark that God had commanded him to build, we are rescued from a civilization gone astray by simply reaching out to God, just appealing to God and saying, God, give me a right heart. God, help me in my life.
That's all it takes.
And that's what he's saying. He says baptism becomes that symbol because baptism is simply that symbol of being submerged, acknowledging our submersion in a society gone astray, in a human nature that tends to want to do its own thing rather than God's thing, and being raised out of that water. Being raised out of that water with a new, clean relationship to God through Jesus Christ. Such a simple symbol. And yet, as Peter says, that symbol even directly relates to this whole story of Noah. God is rescuing us, not by destroying the old, Namor, but by creating new within us. And that's something in which we can rejoice.